I'm joined today by George Constance, who with his wife is the owner and CEO at Indonik Tea and Chai. George, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about Indonik Tea and Chai and, you know, why you're speaking to this audience of cause capitalists. What makes your tea company, which is a retailer and a wholesaler, different from some of the others out there?
Boy, that's a long answer. Sit down, get comfortable. I'm actually trained as a geologist, and I worked as a paleontologist for 20 years. And I look at everything in terms of evolution. And I'm really annoyed when people want to tear down capitalism and through some kind of arrogance want to build something new from scratch. And I don't think solving our world's problems is going to happen like that. What we have to do is take capitalism and actually change it slowly, let it evolve so that it can become something that's better than what it is today. And I think my contribution to that is program Tea for Two through Indonik, where we take 10% of every sale we make right off the top and donate that to an NGO who's working with the people who produce our products. That way no one's left out of the profit stream. And that's it in a nutshell. We can break it down a little bit more than that. But I'm going to hand it over to you so you can ask some more specific questions.
That's a great answer. I wanted to actually get into your background. You've been running Indonik for 9 or 10 years. You started in New Orleans when you were a resident in New Orleans, and that's where you had the first business and tea shop, correct?
Right. I was born and raised in New Orleans, and I met my wife down there about 15 years ago.
So coming from this background as a geologist and an archaeologist, how did you get into the tea business?
My wife, Daya, was born in India. She's ethnically Asian Indian and was raised in Connecticut. And when I met her, it didn't take too long for us to get attached, and I got to meet Mom and Dad. And I was like a pot or two pots of coffee a day guy, and they offered me a cup of tea, but I'd never had real tea before. I've only had the little paper tea bags, which I didn't like very much. And they made me a cup of chai, Indian-style tea. And that was it. I was hooked on chai after that. And when I made the move from the geology business, jobs were drying up in that, I made a conscious effort to look for a growing market. Tea was growing. I was really hooked on chai. And trying to find the right tea for the chai, I got hooked on all kinds of tea. And it just kept growing from there. I have just tremendous interest in history, and tea has such a rich history. It was so easy to fall into it. So I really got into it and really enjoyed it. And opened a package store in the suburbs of New Orleans. And from there, after about a year, we moved into New Orleans with a cafe.
And how long were you there for?
We were, it was 18 months, I believe, we were open in New Orleans. It was really bad timing on our part. We had a package store in a suburb of New Orleans for about 12 months. And it did well enough for us to take the plunge, put all the money that we had saved up and all of our assets, and we put it into a cafe on a really trendy area of New Orleans, Magazine Street. And it did pretty well. It did so well that we were actually going to expand just before the hurricane hit. Initially, I wanted to sell tea wholesale, but I couldn't sell a bag of tea to save my life to a retailer. So out of frustration, we did the package store and then the cafe. And it hit so quickly that all of my customers were going to their coffee hangouts and complaining about their tea and their chai. So all the people I tried to sell to wholesale originally started coming to me. And by the time the hurricane hit, we were making more money wholesale than we were in the cafe. So
won them over with your product and not your sales techniques.
Yeah, and we learned something there. It's we're not attempting to sell to too many retailers. We let them come to us and we sell to them. We're definitely not going to big boxes, big box stores. We're going right to the customer. That's what worked for us before. And I found that the customers can be, rabidly loyal to you if they really like the product. And we did our best to be as friendly as we could to the customers, provide the best product that we could, and it worked. They became our marketing tool. And things did very well, so what we did 16 months after we were open was mortgage up the house and started up to, expand the wholesale business. And then 2 months later, the hurricane hit. So it was really bad timing. We reinvested in the company just before the hurricane. We were technically bankrupt the day after the hurricane. Just no income and lots of debt at that point.
So what happened after the hurricane? You're not in New Orleans right now. What was that period like, and what caused you to move to Connecticut?
It was because we had a business, we were allowed to go into the city before most residents were allowed. And, you know, from the moment you hit the city, it was terrible. I knew it, as a geologist, I knew it was going to be bad. The city's in a bowl surrounded by levees, and if one of them breaks, you're going to fill that bowl. But I just didn't know. I didn't realize the force of water was going to be that great. And driving through the city, you know, driving for an hour through the city, not seeing anyone, seeing total destruction everywhere. I mean, it was really difficult. I just couldn't see how they could actually rebuild the city. It looked impossible. And when we finally did get to the cafe where we were at Magazine Street, it looked pretty good in that section. It was like 12% of the city that was spared flooding. So there was that little glimmer of hope that, all right, the shop's here. You know, it's debt is really high. That maybe we can make a FEMA loan and get things together. And it just didn't work out. Biggest problem was the FEMA loan added to our debt, but we had no customers. The return to the city was like 20% the first year, and none of them were our customers. A lot of them were FEMA workers. So it didn't take too long. I sent my family to Connecticut, where my wife's parents live, and I tried to rebuild for about 6 months. It just wasn't working, and I eventually joined them up here in Connecticut. So we're here and trying to rebuild as an internet store, which is much cheaper than a new cafe.
Mm-hmm. And how's the experience for you? I mean, initially you wanted to do wholesale, so you wouldn't have that would exclude that customer reaction and that type of atmosphere that you were able to create in your mm-hmm. cafe. And, mm-hmm. and now you're back into that more isolated and personal. Is it, what is that like for you?
It's a real challenge. The cafe that we had, it was a really interesting cafe. I've written this on my blog and a few other places that my very first customer was an exotic dancer from Bourbon Street. My second customer was a Catholic priest, and we had everyone imaginable, everyone in between, come into the cafe. There was a tattoo parlor down the street. We had it wasn't uncommon to see a few Mercedes and some chauffeur driven. Patrons get out of their cars and come into the cafe. Some movie stars who were in town, a lot of the local celebrities were in there. So it was a really cool place to hang out, and we made it aesthetically pleasing. It looked like what we wanted to do was create a warehouse, an import warehouse. We imported spices, tea, textiles, and things like that, so that you got the feeling that you were getting something exotic. And recreating that feeling on the internet is really difficult. You have the customer sitting at a terminal somewhere else in the world, and you just have this little screen to try and convey that feeling, and it's very, very difficult. We're having a hard time with that, and we've hired some marketing help to try and help us with that. Their suggestion was just to be yourself. Keep plugging away at the blog, and type up whatever comes to your mind, and hopefully people who think like you are eventually going to find you. So we're hanging on, trying to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you always have a conscious capitalism component to Indonique, where you're giving 10% of profits to the people who pick the tea?
No, we didn't. The hurricane was made a tremendous impact on our lives. We realized how lucky we were, and it was so bizarre. When we drove out of New Orleans. Excuse me. It didn't take too long to get into a place that wasn't affected by the hurricane. Their daily life was going on as usual. When we got up to Connecticut, it was a really pretty day. Everyone was going about their business as if nothing had ever happened. And when disasters were hitting other places around the world, we couldn't help but notice that they had nowhere to go. We were very, very lucky. We had somewhere to go. It was a very rich country. People were doing favors for us. There's this one incident that happened when we were evacuating. There were long lines at the gas stations. There was an oil shortage, a gasoline shortage, coincidentally. That's really bad luck. A lot of them are closed. We're running out of gas. We got this minivan, you know, packed with everything we own. And we're in line. At, we found one station that was open. We're in a long line. Excuse me. And people opened up the line when they saw our license plate, Louisiana license plate, and let us cut in. And people were offering us money. We didn't take any, but it was really touching to see people doing things like that. And, you know, you don't normally expect that. So it's we realized how lucky we were living where we are and having family up here, even, you know, even more importantly. But, you know, most people around the world don't have that. There's nowhere to go when something like that happens. They just suffer. So with that in mind, we took a look at our supply chain. And we knew there were problems with it, but if you look not too hard, you'll find even more problems. And we couldn't, in good conscience, make a profit off of someone else's misery. So we debated, what can we do? You can't stop buying from fields that don't treat their workers well because they'll be even worse off. So we decided that what we have to do is have them participate in the more profitable end of the business, on the retail end of the business. So we made them preferred owners. They get 10% off the top. There's no cheating. If it's profit sharing, you can cheat. I mean, I've got an accountant who makes me lose money even if I make money. The profit sharing just doesn't work. If it's 10% off the top, that works. And for oversight.
What do you mean by profit sharing? If they're getting, X percent of the business?
Yeah. There's a lot of companies offer, 10% of their profits. But if, right. If they don't show a profit at the end of the year, you know, they paid out salaries and bonuses and there's no profit. There's things still claim they did 10% of their profit.
Nothing.
But
if,
10% of nothing's nothing. So and to get around that, we offer 10% off the top. It's a $10 box of tea. $1 goes to Mercy Corps. And we send it to an NGO because they can affect change much more cheaply than we can. I believe they're at 82 cents to the dollar, actually makes it to the programs. And we offer open accounting as well, so that Mercy Corps can at any time demand to see our books to make sure that they're getting their fair share, their 10%. And one reason we chose – I'm sorry, go on.
No, you go, please.
Mercy Corps, another reason we chose Mercy Corps is because they're very business-minded. And I spoke to their representative in Darjeeling, and he kept reminding me, and I was happy to hear this, actually. He kept reminding me that the owner here is cooperating with them, and he's doing what he can for his employees, but keep in mind, he has to make a profit. And I am all over that. Everyone has to make a profit. I had a friend up here who told me that, you know, if you're going to be doing this humanitarian thing, you better not buy an expensive car. You should drive around in a Volkswagen or something like that. And I couldn't, you know, he didn't get it. I had to remind him that I want to be wealthy. I want to make lots of money. And if I'm driving around in a Ferrari, great. That means I've made a whole bunch of money for the people on the other end of the supply chain. I really think you can make capitalism work for everyone. And as long as you include everyone in it, you're doing okay.
So, great. You know, frankly, I'm in the same mindset as you, and it's always interesting to have these discussions. So for you, did you always feel that way, or did that understanding or realization come from your, the aftermath of Katrina and really looking at your fortune and the misfortune of others who you're connected to through your supply chain?
You know, it's I did not think this way before the hurricane. I mean, I was, you know, I like to think I was a nice guy. My, I'd been to India, saw the misery there, and my wife's Indian, so there's a connection to people there. But I took the traditional capitalist point that, you know, I'm going to make it rich and then give back. And I don't think giving back is going to work from now on. I think you should give immediately. You should incorporate people into the whole process. It's a gamble on my part because I don't have a marketing budget. My marketing budget is what I'm doing with you right now. I'm hoping that other people, like-minded people, see what I'm doing, and that's my marketing. But before the hurricane, I was under the opinion that, you know, they can hold on. I'm going to make money, and then I'll give back. But that's definitely not the way to go. And the hurricane definitely affected me because, you know, it's like if a dog bites you, you're very sensitive to being around dogs at that point. That's the same thing with, you know, a disaster hits. I'm very sensitive to disasters. When the tsunami hit or when the earthquake hit Haiti, I'm thinking about these people because I know there are lots of things to consider that most people don't consider. you know, they, you know, people were stuck in New Orleans for almost 2 weeks, and a lot of them were found dead. They think they may have died after about a week or two. It's because they didn't have water. You can only last 3 days without water, and if the place floods and there's no water to drink, there's, you know, never mind the food. It was 105 degrees. People were holed up in attics. They were dying. So there was lots of things that are happening that you don't consider. The earthquake was terrible, but then not a lot of people are going to be dying from diseases and things like that. So the hurricane did affect us. Again, we were so lucky we didn't have to experience all that, but we did see the potential for the misery that occurs afterwards.
So when you had this point that you wanted to give back, and what I'm trying to get at is, did you feel that you had a choice? Was that, okay, we could give 10% back and that's the right thing to do, but shoot, you know, we're really struggling now and I've got a family and we just relocated and I have to build the business again and mm-hmm. I could really use that 10%. Did you go through that, or was it like, no, this is absolutely, there is no choice here. I'm so compelled to do this.
The latter. We're compelled to do it. Right now, the 10% comes out of our pocket. My wife works as a physical therapist. God bless her. If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't be eating. The company brings in barely enough money to pay the 10% because there are a lot of expenses that we have to that we incur that eat up our income. So, but we do contribute 10%. Quite often, we have to kick in personal money to make up that 10%. Or another way, we have to kick in money to support the business so that the 10% can go to Mercy Corps. But like I said, open accounting, we make sure that 10% goes. It's not an option. It's like the old church tithe where 10% or 11% has to go. I'm sorry?
Is there books or people who inspired this? I mean, were you reading about microfinance or other crowd capitalist entrepreneurs at the time that kind of guided you and made you understand that this can be a viable business model?
Yeah, I consider myself an integrator. What I did for a living as a paleontologist, I integrated paleontological data with geological data and geophysical data and other types of data, and I was very good at integrating stuff. And I was influenced by all the authors you mentioned and all the programs out there, Water for Water and the fellow wrote Two Cups of Tea. Those all inspired me, but I found problems with a lot of things. Fair Trade was another one that I liked, but I found a lot of problems there too. So I just looked at what they were doing and tried to think of a way to integrate it and make it better. And I'm a firm believer that none of these problems that we're addressing, none of the programs that we're using are going to work. If we're going to alleviate misery, we've got to make people richer around the world. We've got to, and the word I keep using is include them in the business. They have to be part of the business. And if they're part of the business and you do well, they're going to do well. You don't have to give back. You build them into your business so that they're part of the whole process. And if we don't do that, you know, it's so easy when business goes down to not make that donation at the end of the year, to not give back. And when profits are down, profit sharing, you know, goes down too. So I firmly believe that we're not going to solve our world's problems without including the whole world in the solution. I don't know if I'm clear on that. Sometimes I think it's a really great idea. I'm probably the worst salesman for the idea, though.
No, I don't think so. I think the idea of inclusion and building it into the business is very clear. I mean, and that's there's all sorts of ways that traditionally we do that through different shareholders and stakeholder mechanisms, and now we're just kind of extending that stakeholder circle.
We're letting it evolve.
So your key is picked. Is it all sourced from India, and who are the pickers? I want to get back to kind of the roots of this and how you realize the problem of their kind of their welfare, and then approach Mercy Corps as a partner.
The decision to actually, what I wanted to do was every box of tea that I sell, the people who picked the tea in that box would be the recipients of that 10%, which is the ultimate goal. But I put together a board of advisors with members from the local community, some Hartford attorneys, some UConn professors, And they slowed me down. They said that this is exactly what you should do. This is where you should go. But what you're going to have to do is select one program, one part of India, and everything goes there. And then you can expand it from there. So that's what we're doing. I looked for NGOs in tea growing regions, and Mercy Corps is operating in Darjeeling, India, and they're discussing moving into Assam, India. So what I'm doing is I'm shedding lots of my teas. As I run out of stocks, I'm eliminating teas that from places like China and Taiwan and other places, and I'm trying to replace them with teas from Darjeeling and Assam. And as right now, business doesn't provide me the luxury of dictating what teas they produce. But as volume increases, I'll be able to not only drop teas but replace them with teas from those regions. So right now, you know, there are only a limited number of tea types that you can get from different estates. But with volume,
you're focusing on those regions because that's where you have the Mercy Corps program in place.
Right, that's exactly right. And they would love to expand with me. And I'm anxious to do that with them.
How did you approach Mercy Corps? This is something I get questions from entrepreneurs who are interested in setting up partnerships with nonprofits, but they're very small, like you and your wife, it's one or two people launching a fledgling business. And sometimes they have a hard time connecting to a nonprofit. I mean, they might have one in mind that requires a much larger, $100,000 minimum contribution. So can you walk us through your process of connecting with Mercy Corps and forming what sounds like a very functional partnership, but one that they're as equally excited about?
It was very difficult finding Mercy Corps, first of all. But when I did, I found a champion there, Cully Lundgren over in Cambridge. He operates the He works for Mercy Corps in that area, and I just had a long talk with him.
Cambridge, Massachusetts. So you started locally.
Yeah.
So
right. I got on the phone and I talked with him, and I was very lucky in that he's very business minded. He likes this business approach. So we were kindred spirits, and I drove there and I talked to him, and he liked the whole process. And we had a conference call with some of the senior members of Mercy Corps on the West Coast. And they actually conferenced in a fellow named Strickland in Darjeeling. And then I eventually talked with the owner of one of the estates in Darjeeling. And they just liked the program. They liked the concept enough to take a risk. And I let them know, look, I got the wind knocked out of me in New Orleans. I'm starting from zero. And they said that, every dollar counts. They love the concept. And I told them, whether you like it or not, I'm going to be sending you money. And they thought that was pretty funny. And they liked it enough to work with me. So it was serendipity. I got the right guy who was very business-minded, who put me in touch with some of their people. And I believe Mercy Corps is much more business-minded than most NGOs, and they're getting more so. They're becoming very effective. The fellow I spoke to in Darjeeling kept telling me that, remember, they have to make a profit in Darjeeling. So, we're all on the same page, and we just got lucky.
What would the risk be to them? You mentioned that they are willing to take that risk.
The only risk is you have to, when you associate with anyone, if someone's using your name, you have to make sure that they're doing the right thing. And one reason I think they're comfortable with me is, well, they met me, we talked for a while, and I have open accounting. So I put it in writing. If you want to look at my books, I gave them a business plan. I said, at any point, and I keep reminding them, just, call me up, call my accountant, and full disclosure. And that you're getting your 10%. And they keep an eye on me. If I post something, I get a call from them every night, and make sure the language is correct. And it's more not so much as warning me, it's just helping me. So they're really good guys. I was really impressed.
Do you think that it helped you to forge that partnership that you came in with a plan? You knew what you wanted to do. You knew the form that your partnership wanted to take, and like you said, you had the business plan. You weren't just coming and saying, hey, I've got some ideas, and I'd like to work with you, and it could go this direction, it could go this direction.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, is it helpful to have something that they could basically say yes or no to?
Yeah, I submitted a formal business plan to them, indicating that they would be the NGO of choice. and they took it apart, and they did. They had some issues with some parts of it, but it was strong enough that they wanted to discuss those issues, and we corrected them. So you have to, if you want to approach an NGO like Mercy Corps, you're going to have to approach them as a business partner. You're going to have to submit a formal business plan. You're going to have to, you're going to be tested, and it better get their attention the first time because they're very busy people.
So how does the partnership work now? What do you, every month or every X time period, you send them money and they distribute that how, as they see fit in those regions?
Exactly.
Do you have, okay.
As they see fit, my only request is that it goes to tea growing regions in India. And wherever it's most needed, they will apply it. And
that means that not necessarily it's going to sometimes it would go to the pickers, sometimes it would go for infrastructure like water or telecommunications. Is that correct?
You've done this, Olivia. You've done this before, obviously. that's how they posed it to me. They said, "Look, no, we can't give cash to the growers. So that would not be a good idea." And I agreed. Let's change the language to make sure that no one thinks that. It's going to build. It may build a school. It may build a bridge. It may. There may be a road that goes to a clinic that they can't use because it was washed out. It may repair that. It may pay for a doctor. Whatever is needed at the time, Mercy Corps knows they're there. So I give them full range.
Right.
Full range. Sorry.
And I think that's really important for people, for individuals and businesses who are doing them. And it's tempting to try to earmark because we have these ideas and we think that we want our money to go for what we believe in or what we think is most.
Yeah, you have to pick the right NGO.
Right, and it's really, we're not on the ground and we don't see how these work. And so they put you, as you said, pick the right one who can kind of say, sorry, it's not a good idea for them to have direct cash for whatever reason.
Right. They know there are there are cultural differences that have to be dealt with too. So you want someone on the ground who's familiar with the terrain to make those calls.
So I want to focus now on your customers. How aware are they of your programs? Does that make a difference? I mean, certainly you've won people over before purely with the quality of your tea and your product. So is this a bonus, or are they aware of it? Does it matter to them? What's the reaction or the feedback that you're getting?
So far, I'm doing a really bad job of promoting the program Tea for Two. I'm doing much better with the quality of the tea. I talk to a lot of customers, and they know that we have some charitable aspect to the purchase, but they're not aware of exactly what's going on. So one reason why I hired a marketer, I need to get the point across that we're talking about a huge change in the way business is done. This is I hate to use the word revolutionary, but everyone does it. But it's a new way of doing business, and I'm having a hard time getting that word out. A lot of people love my tea; they like the whole feel that seems to be working. But I want to get that program Tea for Two out there. I think that's what's going to make the business fly, and I think that's what is going to be our shining quality. So I want everyone to know about that, and I'm hoping people like you can help me spread that word.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely needed. And you mentioned marketing before and lack of a marketing budget.
Mm-hmm.
The other companies who are conscious capitalism companies that I've read about and spoken with, one of the benefits of having that type of business model is that they are able to spend less on marketing and develop their customers into their advocates. And I know you mentioned that you were able to achieve that when you had the store in New Orleans. They were advocating for the tea and not necessarily for this program, but it's a combination. For example, with Stonyfield Farm, their customers were so into the organic quality and the conscientious quality of the product that they became their advocates for that, and Stonyfield was able to spend much less on marketing. So, I think that is the right thing. Do you market the Tea for Two program on the packaging?
It's not on the packaging. The packaging was purchased before we developed the program, and I had to make it affordable. I had to buy thousands of units. So what I do is when I do ship a package, it goes out with a flyer, a program Tea for Two flyer in it. packages that end up on the grocery store shelves, I have to rely on the retailer to make sure they maintain signage that tells customers about Program T for Two. It's a lot to read, so I need a little help getting that into a quick sound bite.
It is. I mean, it's probably a lot to read, but what you're doing is clear, and you did a good job with that. I wonder, and this it might be difficult because the way that Mercy Corps uses the funds, but if there are stories or pictures that you could tell or show of kind of the direct impact of these funds, I know that they are kind of diffused throughout the region and their needs, but I just think of how successful Kiva is with bringing those direct stories and connecting the lender with the lendee.
I'm losing you there. I'm sorry. One more.
What Kiva does is connecting the lender with the lendee and bringing that into the forefront of their mind. So you're going to stay wholesale and retail, but online, at least for the foreseeable future, working to develop out and T for Two, sticking with Mercy Corps. Do you have anything else planned, or is this just really, you've got to kind of get this message out there now?
With that, primarily, I want to get that message out there. Once we're profitable, I'd like to explore opening up cafes again, and also even sooner, adding new products. Third world products are desired. I like to go into other places like chocolate producing nations, coffee producing nations, and have an Indonesian chocolate, Indonesian coffee, where NGOs in those countries can affect change there as well. So I'm having a little trouble. And one problem I had was I didn't mention is I have some relationships with some tea growers, and they've shied away from me since I started doing this. And I know why. They're conditions in tea growing nations, or most third world nations, are appalling in some ways compared to the way people live in the West. They don't want attention, and I keep trying to convince them that I'm not exposing anyone. What I want to do is help. If there's a place where there's misery, people are working 12 hours a day and not making a living, I want to help. I'm not there to expose you. I'm trying to get your product, sell it, and put some money into their hands. I want to help out. So some of them have come back. Others are just scared to death of me. That's a marketing effort I have on the other end. You know, I'm not selling to the customers that one. I'm selling to my suppliers. So that's a message I would like to get out there. I'm not your enemy. I'm trying to help you. I'm having a hard time with that.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's not a problem that I would have foreseen.
Yeah.
So, George, do you see yourself as a businessman now? Your business has had some ups and downs, most of them circumstantial, unfortunately, but still it was a big shift from your past career. How does it feel? Does it feel comfortable now? Do you feel like a businessman?
Yeah, I am. I'd like to think I'm a new breed of businessman. And, I'm still a paleontologist. I'm working with systems. And I'm taking advantage of systems. I want to make sure that the business is going to evolve, and I'm going to be selected by Darwin to continue. And I think this is the right way to go. I think most people, you want to take care of your family first. And if there's anything left over, then you think about the community at home and around the world. It should be the same thing. And so I think a person who goes into a grocery and they can buy my tea for the same price as my competitors, and they know I'm doing Program T for Two and someone isn't, they're going to pick my product. So I am a businessman, but I'm a new type of businessman. I'm evolving.
We talked about the reaction of your some of your suppliers and some of your customers. Are there other, and you mentioned your friend's comment about driving a jalopy, so to speak. What other type of reaction from friends or colleagues or peers have you received?
I have, it's across the board. A lot of them is, yet another charity. Or, I know so-and-so gives back. Or, I buy fair trade. And, they're not reading the fine print. I have to you know, scream at them. It's not fair trade. You know, I give back dollars, not pennies. It's not a make a lot of money and then give back. It's a new way of doing business. I've incorporated the growers into my business. They are, matter of fact, they make more money than me at the moment. So it's most of the reactions I get from my friends are they just don't realize the scope of what we're doing. Others are thrilled. There's a local grocer here that made prime space for us. They have signage everywhere because they love the program Tea for Two concept that we do. So can I mention the name of the retailer?
Oh, I love it.
I'm sorry, can I?
Oh, yeah, I love it, yeah.
Yeah, Garden of Light natural food store in Glastonbury, Connecticut. They're rabid fans. They do tea tastings, and they promote the product. We do really well with them, and they're a huge source of new customers for us. So, and I need to get more evangelists like that on board.
George, what do you think your strength is in all of this?
Integration again. I like to put systems together, and I can put different systems together. So I've managed to excite a lot of people with the concept because of how well it flows. I've put a lot of things together to make a system that really works. So I have some attorneys from the Hartford on board and a really wonderful NGO on board. All through the business plan that I submitted, they like the system. They think it's something that can be profitable. So yeah, I think I found a solution to the problem. So, you know, I'd like to say I removed the hippies from the giving end and got rid of the Nazis on the other end. So now the rest of us are in the middle here. We want to do right, but we want to make a profit. It's very realistic.
What would you say to other people who are contemplating starting a business that has this type of component to it, and or advice would you give to people who are just doing this now or getting started? So if you could impart some of your wisdom and lessons learned. One of the things, just to answer my own question, one of the things that you mentioned was the business plan, which I have not heard of before as an approach to nonprofits, and mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. And I really thank you for sharing that piece of advice.
Okay.
What else could you share?
Go to Small Business Administration. There's a division called SCORE, where retired executives can help you with the business plan and describe what you're doing. And above all, and I guess one of my strengths is I don't know when to shut up. I expose all my faults within 5 minutes of meeting me. And that kind of honesty goes a long ways. And if you need help, don't be afraid to ask for help. You'd be amazed at how many people, if they like what you're doing, are willing to overlook any of your shortcomings and help you. Again, those the lawyers I know, local lawyers from the who have offered to help me, that I don't know anything about law, and they're doing all this pro bono. And the retailers I spoke with, I didn't have a clue as to how to get into big retail stores. They've been helping me with that. So be honest. Let everyone know. This is what you want to do. This is where you're going. If they trust you, they're going to help you.
And did you find the lawyer through SCORE?
He's a friend of a friend, and a friend of my wife's. My wife's childhood friend's husband, and then she turned out to be an attorney too. So they were just friends. I didn't see that coming.
Right. But part of it is what you said, and I've heard this from other entrepreneurs, is you have to talk about your mission, and you have to let people know, and that's how you'll find your resources, your contacts, and your customers, and that's part of it.
Yeah,
communication,
yeah.
That confidence. In
well,
it.
Yeah, thanks for adding that. You really have to get out there and talk to a lot of different people. And if you're honest, if you're genuine, most people are pretty perceptive, especially people who you need to help you. They're very perceptive. If you're giving them a load, they're going to know. If you're honest and you're hardworking, and they'll sense that right away, and they will help you.
One thing I read today, and this is just kind of slightly off topic, but I saw a plea on behalf of Idealist for donations because they had made most of their revenue on job postings and everything, and with the shrinking the economy, they lost a lot of revenue. And so the founder of Idealist started off by saying, you know, people always say, oh, you should have asked for help. So here it is. And I thought that I kind of thought about the courage that must have taken, because I don't really think of Idealist as in a precarious position. It's kind of always been there. It's always been the forefront of a nonprofit marketplace of jobs and volunteer positions and information. And here they are having to really expose themselves and ask for help from their community.
Yeah.
But I really think it's going to make them stronger. So it's tough, but I think that there's a lot of advantage in that.
Yeah, and the internet's helped with that too. We're so much more connected now. I can go to get on Twitter, and there's 1,800 people see what I'm complaining about or what problem I'm asking for help with.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for the interview. I really appreciate it. It was a godsend. I didn't see it coming, and I'm very positive. I'm very hopeful, and I just can't say thank you enough. Appreciate it, and keep doing the work you're doing.
For more interviews about cause capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.